And on one occasion, this procedure involved the most private part of a male anatomy. This was displayed on big screens all around the conference area. So that's an example of things which you can, with all the best intentions of the world, you can't plan everything.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Malcolm Carradas, who is going to talk to us about his experience in the events industry, particularly 6xing an event coming company to become the world's largest events company. Events is interesting. We have many customers in Procurement Express actually who run events. So maybe I'll learn a little bit today about how they actually function as a business. But before we get into that, Malcolm, maybe you can introduce yourself by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Okay. I had to go back and think about things which even I've forgotten I knew. So I've spent the majority of my working life in Singapore. That's nearly 20 years. I have a degree in geography. I have heli skied in the Himalayas, and I was once an ice cream seller in the south of France. I don't think many people know all those things about me.
Okay, all right. And skiing in the Himalayas, is that a developed industry there, or is this a sort of an off experience?
It was heli skiing. So the only way you could access the mountains was via helicopter. And it was a very boutique company run by some New Zealanders and Canadians and explorer types. And it was only a very limited number of people who could do it each year because the weather conditions were often not suitable for taking up the helicopters.
Sure. And it sounds pretty risky. Is that a risky thing to do? What happens if you fall over halfway up the mountain? Are you on your own or?
You go in small groups and you have an experienced guide. Okay. I mentioned it was heli skiing, but actually my skiing wasn't good enough to do that because it's all off-piste. But I could just about get by on a snowboard. Yeah, it wasn't that difficult because I wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. The most difficult part about it was being at 5,000 meters altitude and really struggling to breathe and getting altitude sickness for the first time in my life, actually. The most challenging bit was actually the altitude rather than the skiing.
Yeah, my wife and I did Kilimanjaro years ago, and almost to the top of the mountain, it was at that stage, it'd been 10 hours of us not bickering, but I wanted to chat and she just wanted to put her head down and walk up the boring mountain. So after whatever it was, 10 hours of me annoying her, she says, "Now listen, just will you ever shut up and just let me walk?" And then of course I was like, "I'm fair enough. You don't want to talk to me. I'm just going to go ahead then." So I walked off about 10 steps. And of course at that altitude, moving any faster than the snail's pace kills you. So after about 10 steps, I was on my back exhausted. And I just watched, her crawl by me with a smirk on her face, looking at my terrain. So anyway, yeah,
it shut me up.
It shut me up. Yeah. I learned my lesson that day. Yeah. So it's not no respect or a fitness or anything else. It's just altitude is going to get you a time.
It's a terrible feeling, isn't it?
Okay. Let me just bring you back in time a little bit. You did train in accountancy, but you had maybe a fortuitous, looking back at it, reason why you got into that world. And tell us the story about how your mother influenced you to going down the world of business.
Yes. My mother had a very important impact on my career because actually, as I mentioned earlier, I have a degree in geography. And when you finish a degree, it's quite hard to decide what you want to do after that. And I must be honest, I wasn't trying very hard to think what I should do. I was quite enjoying the free time and playing a lot of cricket, which I used to enjoy doing. And my mother every day used to ask me, "Are you going to apply for a job or what are you going to do?" And I said, "It's okay. I've sorted everything out. I'm going on a job fair in London tomorrow." Tomorrow came, it was a beautiful day. And strangely, I decided to play cricket again. And my mother said, "Me, are you going to this job fair today?" I said, "It's okay. I've decided what I want to do. I'm going to become an accountant." And the reason I said that was because all my friends had become accountants because it was the easiest job to get into in that time. So having said that's what I was going to do, I then had to make it happen. And I did enroll with an accounting firm to go through the 3-year professional examination. If I knew how tough it was going to be and how demanding on my time, as well as running a full-time job, I probably would not have played that cricket game that day. But here I am. I got through it and I'm a qualified accountant. And it's opened up many opportunities for me. I've been extremely fortunate, the opportunities it's offered me in my life.
Yeah, okay. So you got embarrassed into it, more or less. I mean, that's exactly. A sliding doors moment. Okay, so it's worked out, yeah. On the 28th of February, 2025, I did an interview with Philip Knowles, who was released then, and he's in junior mining. So with your geography background, were you ever tempted to... Because geography and junior mining, those together, mind you, get paid to wander the hills and tap rocks and whatever you do to try and find, but that never crossed your mind.
Well, it did cross my mind, actually. When I was at school, I wanted to be a geologist, but unfortunately, I was unable to do geology A-level because it conflicted with my syllabus. So that's why I thought geography sounds a bit like geology, and that's why I did geography. And then having gone down the geography path, I think I forgot all about becoming a geologist. But yeah, that was my dream when I was at school.
Yeah, okay, very good. There's lots of people who work in finance and geology kind of merge together in junior mining. That's kind of why I asked. Maybe you should, if you have time, check out the interview with Philip Knowles. You might find it interesting. He's in that world. Back to you. So you got qualified and then what happened then? So you worked in audit, was it? Seems like everyone seems to work in audit.
Yes. It was very common to work in audit in those days and then specialize later. So my specialization was really to decide to travel. It's a qualification which you can carry around with you. And so I got a secondment to Australia. And that really began my life of travel. And it never really ended after that. It wasn't really a secondment. It was almost a permanent migration for the next 25 years.
And how did you find an opportunity with events companies or event management?
I was on the secondment in Australia. And I'm not obsessed with cricket, but I actually happened to be meeting an old friend from London at the Sydney Cricket Ground. And he, during the course of the cricket game, I heard him talking to one of my friends, offering him a job, a regional finance role in Singapore with his events company. Mm-hmm. And I interrupted the conversation and said, "You shouldn't be talking to my friend. You should be offering that opportunity to me first of all. I should have first choice." He says, "Oh, do you want it then?" And I said, "Yeah, it sounds quite good, actually." And he must have given me a glowing reference because he set me up with an interview with the regional office in Singapore. I flew over. I arrived, but my luggage didn't. So I had an interview the next morning in the clothes I was wearing. And the guy interviewing me, the CEO, said, "Oh," he says, "the so-and-so," I won't say his name, "said you could do the job, mate. When could you start?" And that was the depth of my interview. And that's how my career in the events industry, like so many other people, just was really by chance.
Very cool. It sounds hardly a rigorous interview process on their part, but it obviously worked out from what we'll hear next. So
no, it was in the office. It was in the office. But yeah, it was a very short interview.
Very good. So tell us, give us a bit of background on the events business in general. When you joined, it was a lot smaller than it turned out to be. But give us an overview of how this business operates and what sort of scale it's at and all the rest.
Okay, so there's many different types of events. Two broad categories are companies which own and organize their own events, professional event management companies who organize events on behalf of large corporations. So for example, if you wanted to have your annual meeting in Paris or something, there are companies that help you organize that. That's not really where I come from. I come from more the side that owns and organizes their own events. And then in that, there's probably two broad categories. There's content-led events, where people get together for knowledge and for networking, often targeting CEOs and C-level people. I guess something like Davos is almost a content-led event. Not quite, it's not a commercial event, but it's to do with content and networking and exchanging ideas. Then there's trade shows, which are what we say are transaction-led. They're basically, it's a marketplace, which takes place over 3 days, where buyers and sellers get together to do business, to build relationships, to generate leads. And I've been on both sides of that spectrum, But my most recent job was on the trade show side.
And these businesses, roughly in terms of, I mean, a lot, the actual deploying the event itself can be a massive logistical issue. But my impression from the outside is that there's also a significant sales component to this in terms of building a sales team to be able to fill out the events. I guess it sounds like, is one need more salespeople than the other? Is more, one kind of like advertising, like I might be used to home holiday shows in Dublin, for example, here, and one might be more specific, like a CFO meeting in Prague, like I would go to the CFO meeting in Prague every year.
Yeah, that's a very good observation. So trade shows, yes, you would definitely need more salespeople, more marketing people, because you're bringing companies together who want to do business. A conference, one of the things which attracts people to the conference are the speakers, the people who have that subject matter expertise, captains of industry or people who are politicians driving policy initiatives or something. They're people you want to come and hear because they're relevant to your business and they've got something to say for themselves. So they're less salesy, those events. The delegates have to pay for the privilege of attending usually. Sponsors will also pay for the privilege of getting brand profile and exposure to C-level people. But it definitely involves more content, like publishing a magazine. You need the content as well as the adverts, whereas a trade show is more towards pure business transactions.
Yeah. And from the outside here, it seems like the conferences are easier to fulfill the promise, if you like, as long as you can get the speakers to turn up. If you go there, you listen to them. Okay, I've listened to them and I met some people and I've been to these conferences as well. I'm like, I can't argue. I did what I said it in the tin and I got the ballage. And I don't know if there was an ROI, but it was definitely what I asked for. But on the other side, the trade shows, it's a lot more black and white. You either walk away with sales as an exhibitor or you don't. Does that mean there's more? Because I'm guessing it's a star system where the minority of people do really well out of the trade show, like there's exhibitors, and then there's sort of people who come once, doesn't really work, and then they churn, and then you get new people.
Yeah, there is an important difference, I think. With a conference, a delegate knows what they're signing up for because they can see an agenda, they can see who's speaking. With a trade show, it's a leap of faith because you're selling someone an exhibition stand, a space on the floor, so that they can conduct business. But then you have to bring that business to them. So you have to go out and find the network of buyers and distributors who will be interested in buying from that exhibitor. And if they stand there for 3 days on an empty stand with no one coming up to them wanting to buy their products or services or talk with them, then you've done a poor job as a trade show organizer. So there is that leap of faith from the exhibitor that they're confident that you're going to bring them sufficient leads, sufficient business to justify the return on investment, which can be significant for participating in a trade show.
So when you joined this events company, you know, they were a lot smaller than they eventually became. It sounds to me like running conferences is a way easier life than running trade shows. Is that true? Or is it just horses for courses? Some people really enjoy the trade show and there's more margin on the trade show maybe, or?
It certainly is partly horses for courses because, like a magazine, you've got people who are good at content and people who are good at sales, and they don't tend to be able to do both so effectively. I think one of the major differences is the barriers to entry for a conference are lower than a trade show. And I think that's driven partly by the venue requirements. So conference, you typically run it in a hotel, in a ballroom, a conference room in a hotel. There are many hotels which offer conference facilities. So you don't really need to make long-term commitments on those venues because there are plenty of alternatives if a particular venue is not available. With a trade show, if you reach a certain scale for a trade show, there are very few venues, even globally, which are big enough to hold your trade show. Right. So you don't want to run the risk of running an event 1 year, finding it's really successful, and then the next year, you don't have a venue. So typically, you have to commit on multi-year terms for this venue. You may not even have an established show at this time. In some parts of the world, because exhibition venues are in scarce supply, they're very expensive as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the venue itself, getting a venue in the right city, the right size, the right time of year. You can pay a huge premium for that, a multiple year commitment. So it's a very significant barrier to entry.
So the trade shows are, sounds like a way more of a big boy business than the conferences. Maybe the numbers are bigger in general.
I think that's fair to say. And the universe for a conference, there are only so many C-level people who are going to visit or attend a particular conference, whereas the number of companies in a particular industry are in the thousands. So the potential universe, the potential to grow a trade show is probably larger than a conference, which can reach a limit.
So would a trade show business have a lot more intrinsic value then in terms of the business itself, you know, equity value, if you say as a retail value? And maybe you go for a bigger exit if you can manage to build up a brand or establish a brand. It's way harder to do. And how are these businesses valued? Is there a rule of thumb? Is it on EBITDA? Is it on turnover? How do they look at it?
It's on EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization. That is the most common metric for valuing a trade show. And they carry it's a very active market in trade shows. Private equity heavily participate in the trade show business these days. There's small entrepreneurs who incubate events to sell to larger companies. So it's a very active market. And because of that, there's established metrics, the multiples of EBITDA. And I think at the very top end, it's probably about 15 times EBITDA for a very good quality trade show or trade show business. Conferences, because there's lower barriers to entry, they command a smaller multiple. And because also the topics can come in and out of fashion, they're not quite robust in their life cycle as a trade show. And a conference multiple would probably be maybe not even half of that of a trade show business. Maybe
the scale would be smaller as well.
It would be smaller, yeah. So probably 4 to 8 for a conference. 8 would be very exceptional. But trade shows can get up to 15 times EBITDA.
And I guess the size, it's interesting private equity are interested. So for private equity to be interested, it needs to be, at least a $5 or $10 million annual business. Is that common or achievable, I guess?
Yeah, in former markets, revenue is more than $2 billion, actually. That was the company I worked for. Wow. And you can go from single show organizers to people like who may have, as you say, $5 to $10 million of revenue, to businesses like Informa, Reed Exhibitions, which have 400 or 500 events a year, let's say around $2 billion of revenue.
Wow. Okay. So running, what's it like to get up to 2 billion, even with a significant show? It's a lot of events, right? A lot of shows, a lot of characters, a lot of different. So tell me the story of six X'd the business. We have to fulfill the promise of the podcast title, I guess. So how did they manage to do that? In what period of time as well?
Okay. So I mentioned that the business that I think we're talking about is in former markets. And I was when I became the CFO of Informa Markets, the CEO at that time just joined the company. His name is Stephen Carter. And he took this hodgepodge of Informa businesses and carved out 4 trading divisions, one of which was Informa Markets, the trade show business. And at that time, it was very small. It wasn't really noticed in the industry at all. But Stephen Carter liked it. Same reason, I think, as private equity. Quite robust growth, so the interesting sectors and also the cash flow dynamics are excellent because you tend to be selling over a 12-month cycle in advance, collecting money and paying your vendors much, much later than you collect from your customers. So the cash flow dynamics are excellent. And so he doubled down on Informa Markets. And over the next 6 years, we went from something like about $300 million of revenue to $2 billion. That's where the 6X comes from. In fact, my math isn't very good because it's slightly more than 6X. And also during that time, the headcount went from about 500 to 5,000. So it was a huge transformation. And size isn't everything, but we did become, and Informa Markets still is, the organizer in the world. And it was very exciting. We already had an excellent portfolio of events, but we went out and acquired, during a binge of about $9 billion, not even better, but equally as good portfolios and businesses. I think today Informa Markets has a fantastic business.
And Maybe you could tell me about how did you have to grow as a finance professional, building a team, managing a 500-person company to 5,000? That's got to be different, or is it homogenous, or was this a sort of a collection of all these industry, all these different events sound quite different sometimes. So yeah, tell me about how you built the finance team over that time.
Yeah, look, it's the opposite to homogenous. It's very multifaceted. Every event has its own set of dynamics, its own character. So I think as accountants, we have a tendency to want to control things, to want to standardize things. Mm-hmm. And I think in the trade show, in the events business, if you try to do that as a finance person, you are going to quickly go quite mad, actually. So I think it's very important to stay calm, to go with the flow, to pick your battles wisely. Because what you're trying to do is harness the passion and the entrepreneurial spirit of people who manage 500 separate businesses, quite honestly, because each show is like a separate business. You don't want to stifle them. And so as a finance person, it can be quite an uncomfortable space to live in initially, but you have to get used to it. When you're building a team, it's a similar sort of thing. You're not looking for people who are really accountants. You're looking for people who have an accounting background, but they're very much business partners, to use a phrase. They're very commercial. They can provide commercial advice on pricing, on margin improvement, on cost management, on scaling the venue or sourcing the team. It's a very commercial role. So you've got to have someone who likes dealing with people, sometimes slightly idiosyncratic people, but you've got to have that enjoyment of working with people and getting out of the office, going to events, of what the business is about.
And okay, so it's sounding quite attractive, actually. This world sounds quite exciting as a business to run in. But if you have that controlling tendency, I can see how it can be maddening. So you've mentioned, yeah, the good news is you get your ticket sales up front. I guess you get your sponsorship maybe up front. I don't know if that's true or not, but
yes, you
get
do,
a lot
yes,
of cash
yes.
up front. Wow. Okay, great. And then on the downside,
you gotta pay. No pay, no play, would say.
Right. Okay. Very good. on the downside, you got to pay your event or your location up front or in multiple years.
In installments.
Yeah. But you do have a lot of cash around, but then it's all about managing the margin once the actual show happens. Is that where most of the money is spent, like over, because there's a compressed period of time in which a lot of money can get spent very quickly. And this is where it gets hairy.
Exactly. You can have the best laid plan in the world. Once you go on site and you build that event, and there's going to be 200,000 or 300,000 people possibly coming if it's a super large event. It's a very complex building site with big cranes and heavy machinery moving in and out. So it's very difficult to budget at a granular level for everything because there's so much. It's so fluid and so dynamic. Once you get on site, things change. You might need extra food. You might need to strengthen a particular structure to meet with health and safety requirements. There's lots of unforeseen things which can happen, but you nailed it because you said it's about the margin. And I think the best way to manage these events is to set them a gross profit margin percentage, coming back to the name of your podcast. It really is all about gross profit. You say, this is your gross profit margin. We need to hit that margin. You have some latitude on how you achieve it, but you've got to achieve it or exceed it. And that's really how you can effectively manage 500 shows in a very complex world. And the people who are running the events, the show teams, they're very much empowered to run their own budgets, to track their own expenses, with support from finance.
So you can't go down to, you can't be worrying about the lights or the runners or the food bill. You've just got to say, okay, listen, this is your total budget. You got to spend to get the hold on for this X million and let the organizer. And then within that, they would have their own processes. Well, however, they want to control the cost. You just can hold them accountable. And that's the only way to possibly scale this sort of thing. Yeah.
Correct. We know what we want to deliver in terms of a satisfactory outcome for our clients. And we know at the top level what budget we have to do it.
Yeah. So building, you mentioned it to me before the show, it's like building a little city almost. And but things go wrong with these pontoons and all sorts and structures and stuff. So what are some of the things that have gone wrong, if you like, on the ground? Are there events who just blow out and just make a total loss and then You just got to take it. Did you budget for those? And what could go wrong on these things?
Yeah, correct. Sometimes you have to make the best of a bad job and just wear the loss, because it's important that you deliver a successful show, even if it's not financially successful for you. So you can cut your losses a bit, but you've really got a duty of care to deliver something for your customers. Things that can go wrong. There are a few examples. We were running a show in Africa once. I won't say which country. Three weeks before the show, we learned that the venue had been subject to a compulsory purchase order, acquisition order by the government. And once they got that through, they immediately went and demolished the venue. So 3 weeks out, we were shown pictures of this pile of rubble, which used to be the exhibition venue. So that needed...
I have to admire their efficiency. I don't know of any government that can CPO something and demolish it within 3 weeks. It shows what can be done if they try, I guess.
I'd say there's a lot of examples, some not appropriate to talk about. I can talk about one which I think is just about appropriate. And this is to do with an anti-aging and aesthetic medicine event. It's a sell-out event each year. And because of that, the venue allows us to put big screens in the public area so that if you can't get inside the conference hall, you can at least see these things on the big screen. So what wasn't properly foreseen was at these conferences, there are live aesthetic medicine procedures which take place. And on one occasion, this procedure involved the most private part of a male anatomy. This was displayed on big screens all around the conference area. So that's an example of things which you can, with all the best intentions of the world, you can't plan everything.
Very good.
You can't think of everything.
I'm sure it took care of marketing for the following year anyway. You got maybe the wrong clientele, but hey. Very good. So let's talk a little bit now about your own practice that you're running. You're offering fractional CFO services. Is it event companies that you're specializing in, or what's the ideal profile for someone who could work with you?
Look, when you start out, you say, I'm not going to specialize in events. I'm not going to pick and choose, and I feel that my skills can be used in many industries, because accountants like to have egos and think they can do everything. But what happens is your network over the last 25 years, or my network, has been mainly in events. So I tend to have more than 50% of my clients are in the events business. And I realize that it's probably the area where I can add the most value. I understand the industry better. But I will say that I will work in any business where I feel I can add value. It's very important. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning, being able to achieve something for the business I work for. It's also important, particularly working with smaller businesses, scale-ups, that I'm a good cultural and emotional fit with the business. It's important that I can strike a rapport with the in-house accounting teams, with the entrepreneurial owners. It's also important that they feel comfortable working with me. So I think I don't just work in the events industry, but I will only work with businesses where I feel I have the competency to help them. I try not to oversell my services.
I'm a programmer by training, so I'm not a master salesperson, but I feel like finance teams do need a bit of sales training sometimes to sell their value. It's the most valuable hire your business can make over, let's say, a couple of million in revenue, and people don't know. They grow up, they build a business from nothing maybe, and they learn that their accountant is the guy who gives them their tax bill, and they think that's all an accountant is. And they go on doing that up into 5, 10, 50, 100 million, and they still don't realize the value that can be delivered by a finance team. And I think hiring the right fractional CFO, I've seen now through doing these interviews, it's hands down the most accretive hire you can make. There's no single salesperson, no single anybody else who can have the impact that the right fractional CFO hire can make. But you're right, it's a total personality fit. That's the trick. You got to find the one that can mix gel with.
Yes. And this thing about value, I think what I learned working for larger companies is the value from a finance person comes from looking into the future and helping businesses to understand what's around the corner, what risks there are, what opportunities there are. Don't be rooted in the past, but help the business realize its forward ambition. Because large companies, when they're presenting to the stock market, although they're not meant to give forward information, that's what the market wants to hear. They want to hear about the prospects. They don't want to hear about what's just happened. They want to hear about what's happening next. A company's valuation in the public space is based on its future prospects, not what's happened in the past necessarily. So I've tried to take this thinking into working with scale-up businesses to help the business owner not look at what happened last month or the month before, but maybe take that information and use it as a basis for looking forward. So we don't focus on, as I say, what we did last year. We focus on the sales pipeline. We focus on the margins. We focus on the cash flow. And that's where I try to add value by going on the forward journey, maybe using the past something as a reference point.
Yeah, that's exactly what a great CFO should be doing for you, to see those opportunities. And it's very easy to get focused on the path. And then, so father-in-law says, he's a mountain biker. If you're looking down the cliffside, that's where you're going to end up. You've got to look up the hill. That's where you want to go. And that's the trick.
That's a good analogy, yeah.
So tell me, how can people get into, I know you have done a number of resources that you have available. I've been reading through some of them, including long-range forecasting and readying a business for sale. How can people get in touch with you or find more of your material?
Okay, I'm on LinkedIn, Malcolm Carradus, CARRADUS. My website, my business is cfoasaservice.com. So you can reach me through my website or through LinkedIn. You mentioned the tools. Yeah, I don't want to turn up with a client and then start from scratch each time. That's not good for me and it's not good for the client. With another person I collaborate with in this space, we wrote a series of CFO playbooks. And some of those playbooks are around 3-year planning, how to prepare your business for a sale, business readiness for sale, receivables management, writing effective reports. I can't think of them all at the moment, but there's a suite of playbooks which I'm happy to share with clients. And I also use them as a basis for running assignments.
Very good. Okay, Malcolm. So we'll just wrap it up then by asking my final question, which is, do you have a business hero? And if you do, why?
Okay, I realize that most of my role models are probably not people from the business world. I guess two in particular, Nelson Mandela, I've always seen as an inspirational person. Modern day sporting hero, I think, is Lewis Hamilton. I also think on the female side, I think Serena Williams is just an amazing person as well. You asked me about in the corporate world, and it's very hard because unless you work with someone, you don't really know what they're like.
Have you worked with Venus Williams? Or
I knew you were going to say that, though.
It's going to be very exciting. I'm being asking you the wrong questions if you had. Okay, sorry, go ahead. I interrupted you.
I think because I like sport, I'm not particularly good at sport. Because I like sport, I think it's easier for me to empathize with a sports person than it is to empathize with a CEO, because I'm not a CEO. But I guess you people better when you work with them, because you see the good points and the bad points on a more of a day-to-day basis. So I think this Informa PLC, which was the mothership of Informa Markets, Stephen Carter, I learned he's probably been one of the biggest influences on my career, because he's someone with a very sharp mind. He has a plan. And I think most impressively, this is what finance people are not very good at. He's a brilliant communicator, and he can really hold a room. He can really convey a message. He can keep it simple and he can keep it clear. And I think that's a skill set that many of us aspire to and many of us never quite achieve, actually. So I think overall, I would say that Stephen Carter has had a very big influence on my career.
I love that. I love being able to nominate someone you actually worked with, because now you have a good excuse to send them the podcast and say, hey, I mentioned you. My secret weapon for adding one visitor, listener at a time is Malcolm, this has been really enjoyable. Thanks very much for giving us an insight into the events business in general. And thank you if you've been listening this far. I think it's appropriate if you have been listening this far, and since we've been talking about events, Pyramid Express is running monthly CFO mastermind groups now. They're online, they're not in person, so not as good as Malcolm's shows. But we do bring together fellow fractional CFOs. We put you in a small group where you get to brainstorm a business problem that you're working on. So this could be a client problem or a practice problem, or just looking for inspiration from people. And they're going very well. And you can sign up for that at procurementexpress.com/CFO mastermind. So Malcolm, thanks very much for coming along. Really appreciate it.
James, it's been a real pleasure, and best of luck with your endeavors as well.